Over 570 million people living in sub-Saharan Africa continue to lack access to electricity. Even if one is lucky to be connected to the grid, enjoying uninterrupted power for the whole day remains a distant dream for many. And the problem is particularly acute in rural areas. Why is this the case? And what types of strategies should policymakers on the African continent pursue?
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Having uninterrupted access to electricity is taken for granted in many parts of the world. In Norway, where I live, we rely on an abundance of hydroelectric power to warm our homes, our offices, to light up our cold and dark winters. The lack of rains or available water in the reservoirs and hydroelectric power stations may occasionally lead to concerns over temporary power shortages, the need for imports, and associated price hikes. But such factors neither pose a threat to our livelihoods, nor do they threaten industrial production. Indeed, our lives are almost never disrupted by a power cut, unless something extraordinary happens, such as extreme weather events. But my childhood was very different. Growing up in India in the 1970s and the 1980s, I can still recall the frequent, almost daily incidences of load shedding and power cuts that characterized much of my upbringing. Things were particularly bad during summer months. Without electricity, the fans stopped working, and particularly in congested cities, like Calcutta, where my parents lived, there was little relief other than spending time outside the home in the evenings as much as possible when temperatures only slightly declined, or spending time on the terrace waiting to catch a bit of cooler, fresh air. Even studying for the exams was a challenge, and one had to rely on battery-powered lamps in the evenings. In a megacity such as Calcutta, economically well-off families could get around this problem by running their private generators. The few houses that were lit up at night were the envy of all. And in these houses, the residents could watch television while fans or air conditioners kept them cool. With rapid economic growth and liberalization and economic reforms, things began to change in India in the 1990s. Power supply became more consistent. Battery-powered inverters became more affordable and more easily available. Indeed, the Prime Minister of India recently announced in April 2018 that all villages in the country now have access to electricity. This, of course, does not mean that all Indians have access to electricity. In India, a village is considered electrified if 10% of its homes and all public buildings are connected to the grid. But the point here is that most Indian cities now do not face the kind of load sheddings that was a routine part of everyday life in India during my childhood. The recent cyclone Amphan that battered the East Indian state of West Bengal and its capital Kolkata in May 2020 resulted in a temporary loss of electricity for millions and brought back memories for some, at least, of the 1980s when uninterrupted power access was a luxury for most people. Following media reports and high-profile political intervention, electricity was, however, restored in Kolkata in record time in May 2020, highlighting once again how electricity is no longer the luxury that it used to be, but has now become an essential part of daily living, at least for urban Indians. Access to electricity is often understood as signifying development. And India, like many other medium-income countries, or so-called emerging countries, considers electricity shortage as a thing of the past. Indeed, people in all parts of the world believe, now at least, that ensuring access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all is a prerequisite for socio-economic development. And yet electricity remains an elusive dream for many Africans. Why is this so? And what can be done about it? So So let's begin with a global overview. According to recent estimates, energy access at the global level has increased significantly in the past decade. So according to the 2019 Energy Progress Report, while 1.2 billion people lived without electricity in 2010, the number dropped to 840 million in 2017. And the global electrification rate currently stands at 89%. Around 131 million people actually gained access to electricity each year on average since 2010. So this is all very impressive. Three countries in particular have achieved considerable progress in recent years. These are Myanmar, Bangladesh, and Kenya. And others, such as Afghanistan and Cambodia, have also made important strides in expanding their grids and thereby improving urban electrification. Some of these countries have also made good use of off-grid solutions, such as solar home systems, to improve access in rural areas. But there is still much reason for concern, because without major, sustained, and stepped-up efforts, an estimated 650 million people will continue to live without access to electricity in 2030. The situation in large parts of the African continent is particularly worrisome. Despite considerable talk in national and international circles on the urgency of solving Africa's power problems, all available evidence points to slow and uneven progress. The problem is most acute in countries like Burundi, Chad, Malawi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Niger, which are among the 20 countries with the lowest electrification rates in the world. As a recent World Bank report on electricity access in sub-Saharan Africa notes, and I quote, "The abysmal record of energy poverty in sub-Saharan Africa has major implications not just for economic growth, but also severely impedes the ability of the state to provide quality social services," end quote. Now, sub-Saharan Africa not only lags behind other world regions in terms of access rates, but the total number of people without electricity has actually increased in recent years as population growth has outpaced growth in electrification. But while most countries in sub-Saharan Africa are struggling to boost production and access to electricity, a few countries, such as Rwanda, have enjoyed notable successes. The Rwandan case is particularly interesting. Despite its small and landlocked status, Rwanda has often been highlighted in the international discourse as a success story that others could emulate. It is one of the fastest electrifying countries in the world, despite having low access rates, and has recently been ranked fifth in making the transition to clean power. So for the past 5 years, Rwanda has been actively promoting renewable energy projects, including solar power plants and off-grid solutions, often through successful private-public partnerships, including a Norwegian firm called Scatec Solar. And although electrification rates in Rwanda continue to remain low, it appears there is a conscientious public policy effort and vision to ensure not just greater production of electricity, but also a much-needed focus on clean and renewable forms of energy. At the other end of the sub-Saharan African electrification spectrum is Malawi, a country I've been studying for a decade and a half. It is among the poorest countries in the world and is heavily dependent on foreign aid. It also continues to have one of the lowest electrification rates in the world. Only around 10% of the population is connected to the grid, and that too mainly in urban centers. And while electricity only accounts for 3% of energy use in the country, 89% of Malawi's total energy supply consists of unsustainably sourced biomass, which has caused widespread deforestation. And the use of charcoal is particularly widespread. Now, rather than initiate more long-term solutions, the government of Malawi recently introduced diesel generators that are very expensive to run to solve the power crisis. These generators require expensive fuel imports, something that is very difficult for a poor and landlocked country to afford. A few months ago, in early 2020, I visited some of the major hydroelectric projects in Malawi and interacted extensively with engineers and administrators. My goal was to better understand what was working and what needed to be done to increase the country's capacity to generate more electricity and make this accessible to larger groups in the population. Since over 96% of current electricity capacity originates from hydropower plants on just one river source, the Shire River, and with the increased advent of droughts and lack of adequate rainfall, the country's ability to produce adequate power for its needs is severely restricted. Power cuts and load sheddings are therefore common for large parts of the day. Malawi has also struggled to attract further investments required to upgrade existing hydropower plants as well as to build newer plants. While several coal-fired power plants have been planned over the years, most have either been cancelled or just shelved. The authorities are currently in consultations with a Chinese company to build a coal power plant, which is being promoted as an alternative to expensive and unavailable investments in hydroelectricity and solar power. So the lack of power generation capacity in Malawi, as in many other countries, is a frequent source of frustration among the population. And in Malawi, as in elsewhere, there's considerable national debate on the adverse impacts the lack of electricity has on the manufacturing sector, on economic growth, and in relation to social development. Thus, while Rwanda and Malawi, the two examples that I've mentioned so far, are small, poor, and landlocked, public policies aimed at promoting energy security in these two country contexts vary greatly, and both countries appear to find it challenging to provide electricity access, particularly in rural areas. So, what type of strategy should policymakers in these countries pursue? Let me discuss three broad sets of issues. The first set of issues obviously relates to the availability of funds and investments for power generation and distribution. Securing domestic financing for major energy infrastructure projects is, of course, important, but so is attracting investments from external actors with proven expertise. And these tasks are not easy because they may come with certain conditionalities, some of which are politically unacceptable, or when conditionalities are perceived to be detrimental to the livelihoods of local populations. An illustrative example is a loan, which, although may contain a concessional element, would nonetheless have to be repaid. Whether an investment worth several hundred million dollars or even $1 billion will pay off in the long run is often difficult to ascertain with precision given the unpredictability associated with future demand for power, potential spillover effects in the economy, and the costs related to maintenance and expansion of the grid. And therefore, undertaking thorough homework in the form of impact assessments and feasibility studies must be undertaken by impartial actors and institutions that can provide good, sound advice to policymakers. China has been stepping up its activities in the energy sector, and in recent years has provided loans and helped build several energy projects, including coal-fired power plants and hydroelectric projects. In recent months, there have also been several new funding pledges by agencies such as the African Development Bank and the Export-Import Bank of the United States aimed at promoting electricity access on the African continent. While some of this funding is earmarked for small-scale solar systems and so-called mini-grids, others are aimed at boosting energy access to electricity in rural areas. But more is needed, not just money, but also technology and advice. A second set of issues relates to environmental impacts. Indeed, a particularly vexing problem for many countries in sub-Saharan Africa relates to the environmental impacts of their energy policy decisions. In recent years, such challenges have received media attention with regard to societal protests over coal-powered power plants. And although supporters claim, for example, that coal is the cleanest, least costly option, many critics wonder why Africa should construct such projects when coal is being phased out in large parts of the world. A proposal to build East Africa's first coal-fired plant adjacent to the Lamu Archipelago in Kenya with a $2 billion Chinese loan is a good example in this context. While the Kenyan government claimed the project would strengthen energy security in addition to creating jobs and reducing poverty in the region, environmental activists and concerned citizens began a wave of protests citing the real threat of increased pollution, the destruction of a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and a 700% increase of Kenya's annual emissions of greenhouse gases. Kenya's National Environmental Tribunal has recently decided to stop this project, citing environmental concerns and a failure to adequately consult the public. Kenyan activists who are celebrating their hard-earned victory are, however, now demanding that their leaders should prioritize, at least in the immediate future, renewable sources of energy rather than coal-powered solutions. It is unclear to what extent the Kenyan government has other options available, particularly since two of the world's most influential actors in the region, China and the United States, believe that coal is the best solution for addressing Kenya's energy needs. On a positive note, the African Development Bank has recently decided not to provide loans to Kenya and other member countries for any future coal-fired plants. Another interesting case is the $5 billion Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, GERD, being currently constructed on the Nile near the Ethiopia-Sudan border by Ethiopia. GERD, or this Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, aims to be the largest hydropower generator in Africa and plans to actually export energy to neighboring countries. When completed, the dam will hold 67 billion cubic meters of water and generate more than 6,000 megawatts of electricity. Now, this will, of course, reduce the Nile's flow, thereby, some would claim, adversely affecting Egypt's reliance on the river for irrigation, fishing, and transportation. So this project, which has been ongoing since 2011, has been fiercely resisted by Egypt. And in October 2019, Egypt publicly declared that talks with Sudan and Ethiopia over the operation of the dam and the future water sharing agreement had reached a deadlock. Indeed, there are fears of a major conflict rising in the region, and Ethiopia's solution to meeting its energy needs has the potential of creating hardships for large groups of the population in the region. So the cases from Kenya and Ethiopia illustrate the need for further attention on analyzing public policies on sustainable energy solutions and transitions and their societal responses in very different political systems that include authoritarian and various types of democratic regimes. The third set of issues relates to achieving policy coherence on energy transitions and policies aimed at promoting electricity. The term policy integration was popularized by various international agencies such as the World Bank, United Nations agencies, the OECD, etc. in the 1990s. And this term, policy integration, has been variously understood as the creation of interdependence, cooperation, and coordination between actors representing various sectors and domains that may, on occasion, even result in shared decision-making. So in terms of policies that promote improved access to electricity, it is particularly important to understand the extent to which there is actually political interest to integrate energy generation concerns with that of distribution, access, and environmental impact concerns. Scholars and practitioners have long argued that thinking about integration across sectors and policy advice represents a challenge to the way in which development work is typically conducted. Many political leaders and the institutions they head are typically accustomed to working in silos. Achieving policy integration for energy transitions, whether they are just to generate any type of electricity or more sustainable energy in sub-Saharan Africa, will require a reorganization of national administrations and government systems. There's no doubt about that. There is growing talk in international forums on the need to intensify efforts to achieve sustainable development and the ambitious sustainable development goals, particularly those related to sustainable energy. But most countries in sub-Saharan Africa are yet to begin mapping existing policies and programs against the 169 cross-cutting targets of these 17 sustainable development goals that world leaders agreed to in 2015. When engaging in energy policy making and implementation, political and administrative leaders in such contexts, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, but also all over the world, typically do not like to at least publicly discuss, mention the word trade-offs. In private, however, they insist that they prefer prioritizing a few key goals among, let's say, the 17 SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. These are the goals that they feel they can fund rather than trying to integrate all kinds of developmental goals related to sustainable development. So prioritizing one or two rather than 17 is what most political leaders tell me when I speak to them. Indeed, while the global discourse on sustainable forms of energy increasingly highlights the importance of pursuing an integrated approach to economic, social, and environmental aspects of development, I believe it often overlooks issues of local justice and the messy local politics, including the competition between groups for control over scarce resources. Most low-income countries are faced with a set of difficult choices. Should one simply just say yes to short-term measures such as the introduction of diesel generators that require expensive fuel imports? At least that is what Malawi has done. But perhaps there is little option for governments but to choose such short-term measures when longer-term solutions are not on the table. Longer-term solutions such as a solar power plant or a coal-fired power plant or a hydroelectric project that can guarantee power for several decades but is expensive and nobody is willing to invest in such projects. In addition to exploring new and effective mechanisms for policy planning and implementation, intersectoral collaboration and knowledge sharing appear to be crucial. There must also be greater focus on better understanding the incentives for politicians to use available scientific evidence to promote a much more integrated approach to sustainable development, and in particular, in this case, to solving some of the energy problems related to the lack of access to and also the lack of sufficient generation of electricity. As governments struggle to formulate and implement energy policies aimed at boosting power generation and making electricity more accessible, they're increasingly being forced to make hard decisions and address numerous trade-offs. The need of the hour, I believe, is to demonstrate genuine political leadership and investigate the potential of long-term and sustainable alternatives to power generation, including investments in renewable energy. Securing financing for such investments, as I've discussed here, is often a challenge, and the world community and the private sector must be mobilized with the right combination of incentives and regulatory certainty. Policymakers would also benefit from the availability of better quality and affordable data. One good example would be geospatial planning, using satellite images for designing electrification roadmaps. This would also allow governments to identify low-cost options and better target their interventions. But all of these strategies require political enthusiasm to plan, coordinate, and execute. Consumers and businesses in Africa must demand and expect more from their governments. Several academic studies find that policy integration on sustainable development, particularly related to energy policies, is best achieved when policies are focused at the local community level. Policies that try to integrate energy policy with agricultural concerns, with nutrition, and with the health concerns of smallholder farmers. But even when such evidence is readily available, the decision to choose among a list of alternatives for governments, whether this list of alternatives is a long list or a short list, may not be easy. And this is particularly the case when alternatives that governments have in front of them do not tend to differ much from one another. Attracting investments and achieving policy coherence in energy policymaking and implementation that pays close attention to the needs of local communities, particularly in rural areas, appears, at least to me, to be the key to solving Africa's power woes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. I hope you will join me in the next episode when I will discuss whether a fast-growing world population will further exacerbate the adverse impacts of climate change.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.